This is a rebroadcast of a previously recorded program.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today, we are spending the hour discussing an incredible Pulitzer Prize-winning work of investigative journalism. Poisoned is an 18-month, three-part series by Tampa Bay Times investigative reporters Corey Johnson, Rebecca Woolington, and Eli Murray. Poisoned is about Gopher Resource, a Tampa, Florida-based lead factory where workers extract lead from used car batteries, melt it down, and turn it into blocks of metal to then resell. Part one reveals that hundreds of workers have been exposed to dangerous levels of lead. The consequences have been profound. Part two reveals that equipment designed to control poisons inside Gopher Resource kept breaking down, creating more dangers for workers. As violations mounted, regulators were absent. Part three reveals that Gopher Resource promised changes, but it kept polluting. The three journalists spent 18 months examining thousands of pages of regulatory reports and company documents, including data tracking the amount of lead in the air and in workers' blood. They interviewed more than 80 current and former workers, 20 of whom shared their medical records. Company officials would not agree to an interview. Gopher's chief operating officer, Eric Robinson, issued a statement to the Times and answered some questions in writing. Joining us to discuss Poisoned is Corey Johnson. Corey is now a reporter with ProPublica. He spent 5 years as an investigative reporter with the Tampa Bay Times. Corey Johnson is the sixth Black journalist to win the Pulitzer in the investigative reporting category since it was created in 1964. Hi, Corey. Thank you so much for joining us again. And huge thanks to you and your colleagues for this important investigation.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here and to be able to talk with your listeners here. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And to start off, Corey, when and how did you all find out about what was happening in the Gopher Resource Factory?
So, you know, it was a journey, and it was a journey kind of rooted in some, something very personal to me. When I got hired, when I came to the Tampa Bay Times in January 2017, I, like everybody else, had been watching the news reports from, you know, months prior of what was happening in Flint, Michigan, with the lead in the water. And I saw those images that many people saw, brown water coming out of the faucets and the like. And it hit me deeper than maybe the average person, because on my mother's side of the family, all my family is from Flint, Michigan. And I can remember going up to Flint as a young man, as a child in the 80s, every summer we would go up there to go to grandma's house, and I would drink that water and it would taste god awful. And I can remember the very first time I saw someone with bottled water. My aunt had her own water cooler in her house, and we're talking 1982, 1983, because the water tasted so bad. And at that time, people clowned my aunt. Buying water is very regular now, but back in 81, 82, 83, 84, people criticized and laughed at you for buying water. It's like, water is free everywhere. What fool would buy some water? But yet in Flint, Michigan, even going back that far, it was known to a lot of people about the janky water, if to keep it blunt. And so seeing that in 2016 and introduced me for the first time to lead. And just on a whim, I just started to read what I could about what lead does. And as I discovered that, you know, lead was horrible in the human body, and particularly with children, that it just a little bit of lead could cause permanent brain damage. The lead could go to a child's brain and injure the areas of the brain that dealt with IQ and impulse control and behavior. And I started to wonder if lead was a bigger problem than just Flint, Michigan. And so when I got hired at the Tampa Bay Times, I started to look around to see if the paper had done any coverage of it in any meaningful, focused way, and found that it hadn't. And so I immediately started to reach out to the schools and ask the local school district what they were doing around lead. And that those questions resulted in a series of stories that revealed that the school district had a huge lead problem and that they had known about it and essentially covered it up and didn't tell the teachers or the students, nor did they take steps at that time to remove the bad water fountains and the bad sinks. And so they were knowingly exposing kids and teachers to high amounts of lead without their knowledge. And so we wrote some stories about it, and that got incredible response from the community and forced the school officials to make serious changes to fix that. And as that reporting was happening, I got a call from a confidential source in the local health department to meet. And as I met with that source, they handed over a state report of about 165, 66 pages. But in there were two pages that were dog-eared for me to pay attention to. And those pages talked about lead poisoning throughout the state of Florida. And it turned out that Hillsborough County, which is the area that we report on, led the entire state of Florida in the numbers of people who were getting lead poisoning, particularly adults, that more adults were getting lead poisoned in our county than anywhere else in Florida. And while that was a red flag, because Hillsborough County is not the largest county in Florida, Miami-Dade, where they're bigger counties with more people, older buildings, all of the key things that scientists and researchers look at when they try to factor in lead. And so it felt odd and incredibly important to try to figure out why Hillsborough County had so many adults who were getting lead poisoned. The report also hinted at the role that a battery recycler was playing a key role in this. The report didn't identify who the recycler was. And so that became a focus to try to figure out who was doing this and why. And that's how the reporting essentially got started.
And why did this official reach out to you and give you these documents?
Because they were noticing the coverage and noticing various high schools and elementary schools and middle schools that we were identifying. And the official wanted me to know that it wasn't just these schools, that the problem was far bigger and far more expansive than just some water in a school somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm incredibly appreciative that happened. Because at the time we were just focused on the schools and we had no idea that it was a bigger, more broader problem.
Wow. I mean, we'll talk about this later in the show, but that just speaks to the power and the importance of local investigative journalism.
Yes, it does. It does. I mean, and the Tampa Bay Times is very, very fortunate in that even though in this environment of fake news and people having, some legitimate gripes about coverage and then some more politicized gripes about the coverage, there's still very much a deep appreciation and respect for the Tampa Bay Times as a news institution for the most part in this area. And people still read and they still, think about the coverage, particularly if it's more of a watchdog and investigative type. And I'm grateful for that because it just proves that is not dead. Just as a sidebar, after we won the Pulitzer Prize, my team was invited to go to the soccer match of the local professional soccer team. And they brought us down on the field and we got this huge, like a huge ovation from the crowd when they told us, when they told the crowd why we were there, we won the Pulitzer and what the stories had done. And for the rest of that night, people were just coming up saying, thank you for your work. Thank you for what you're doing. We really appreciate that. And so people still very much want, need, and appreciate good journalism, despite what you might see online or in social media.
It's such a great point. So let's talk about Gopher Resource. As you report, over the last decade, more than a third of the lead battery recycling factories in the United States have gone out of business, including one in South Carolina that shut down last March. Only 10 such factories remain. Why are these lead battery recycling factories going out of business?
Well, the lead industry and these battery recyclers, it's a dirty business. They utilize, and dirty, not saying dirty bad, but they use a lot of toxins and chemicals to take the lead, to refine it, to make products. As a result, that stuff has to go somewhere. And there have been incredible horror stories in the past about these companies dumping these toxins in various communities, in various streams and waterways, and just creating a lot of pollution and a lot of people being impacted. Just in California, down south, in the LA area, there was a very infamous lead smelter, I think in Vernon, California, that resulted in a lot of federal prosecutions and lawsuits around the poisonings of the local community that smelter was doing. And so as the regulations and the rules have begin to get better and tighter to protect communities, a lot of these companies have just felt like it wasn't economically viable to make the improvements and still make their profits. And so as a result, a lot of them have gone out of business. And in Florida, we still happen to have one that has not gone out of business, that promised and pledged that it could operate safely and still be profitable. And what essentially this, the investigation proved or showed is that that was far from the case.
And as a citizen, you would never know, because when you go to the Gopher Resource website, you read, our facility in Tampa provides advanced battery recycling services and hundreds of green jobs for citizens throughout the Tampa region. And then when you click on the factory, it says battery recycling. Our Tampa facility keeps nearly 12 million spent lead batteries from landfills annually. Now, if you're a recycler and you care about the planet, you would think, hey, there's this, the two words, green energy. This sounds fantastic. And then you might just walk away without really thinking, wow, well, what does this mean for the workers? And what does this mean for the surrounding community?
Yeah. And, you know, the irony of it is that when we approached the regulators with a lot of our findings, they too thought that the green jobs and that the plant was much safer than what it was. And that we also found, as we dug into it, that this plant did not have to be this dirty. It did not have to be this dangerous. There were just a set of things that happened that compromised a lot of the fail safes and a lot of the systems that are in place to make it a safer, healthier environment. And when that happened, improving those systems ended up costing more money than the company really wanted to spend. And so they ignored it. So is there a possibility that a smelter can operate safely? Yes. But that went terribly sideways in Tampa.
You report that this company was founded 75 years ago. It generates hundreds of millions in annual revenue, according to one financial analyst. Clients of Gopher Resource have included the U.S. military, battery makers, and ammunition suppliers. The factory is about 6 miles east of downtown Tampa, next to a CSX rail yard, a half a mile from Kenley Elementary. Its smokestacks tower above the community of small residential homes, auto repair shops, and places of worship. So just to place it for a visual, to let people know that there's a community that's surrounding this plant.
Yes, a very old community, once very proud community. The community is going through a little bit of a demographic change. Some of their people have gotten older. A lot of people have left because of the smelter. But yes, it is a very active and vibrant community right next door to a lead smelter. There's an elementary school that is a stone's throw away, if you will, from the smelter. And so much so that if you go to the school, one of the government's pollution air monitors is right there next to a slide where children play. So the children's playground is right next to a government air pollution machine that is actually calculating how much lead is in the air that's getting next to that school. And so it just makes it very real. If you were to go out to the plant at any given time, there's these huge trucks that are driving around spraying water in the air and on the ground with the idea that they're trying to keep whatever lead that has fallen down onto the ground wetted so that the wind can't pick it up and blow it into someone's face or blow it into someone's yard. So yeah, the idea that a community, that a lead smelter could be plopped right in the middle of a community was really fascinating slash, you know, intriguing. And it was a point of something that we ultimately dug into as well separately.
Today, we're speaking with Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter Corey Johnson, who spent 5 years as an investigative reporter with the Tampa Bay Times. He and two colleagues worked on Poisoned, an 18-month, three-part series about Gopher Resource, a Tampa, Florida-based lead factory where workers extract lead from used car batteries, melt it down, and turn it into blocks of metal to resell. Actually, it's Minnesota-based, but they have a plant in Tampa Bay. Corey is now a reporter with ProPublica. So let's talk about some of the workers. As you report, more than 300 people work at the Tampa location. Many are Black or immigrant. Some came to the plant without a diploma or straight from high school. Others, as they restarted their lives after arrest or time in prison. And the job offered about $20 an hour with some bonuses, more money than some workers believe their circumstances would allow. So tell us more about these workers and what an average day is like. They're long days, about 12-hour days.
Actually, the plant never closes. It's a 24-hour operation. There's two shifts, a day shift and an overnight shift. And there are people, you know, in that building constantly, you know, working on creating lead at all times of the day and night. The workers who come there are usually, it's a mixture. There's some guys who get there, and it's mostly men who work inside the plant. Most of them get there. There's some that get there. The younger men get there either because of they graduated high school or left school and needed like a little straight job to work. There's some college kids who need some extra money and doing it on the side. But then the bulk of the workforce are older men, either some guys who stubbed their toe in life. Maybe they went to jail, or maybe their education wasn't that great. And as such, don't have a lot of the options that someone else who might didn't have a blemish would have. There's a bunch of workers who have come from other countries, Haiti, the Caribbean, some continental African workers, Cubans, Puerto Ricans, all who, you know, have come to America looking for better opportunity, you know, be able to feed their family, send money back. And so they too have been attracted to the job. It takes, like, your average person would avoid a job like that because it's hot. Everyone there is wearing spacesuits. They almost look like something out of Star Wars or a hazmat. They're wearing like hazmat type suits, and with these big respirators to cover their face to keep the dust and the toxins from creeping in. And so if you can imagine how hot one of those suits would be over their regular clothes, but then you put them around, you know, a fiery furnace where the heat up there is rising, the furnace is running well over 1,000 some degrees. It's dusty. It's nasty. It's often not air conditioning. The company has tried to improve the air conditioning over time, but a lot of days the air conditioning isn't working properly. The ventilation system is supposed to be sucking the dust and the lead that's being created. It creates this residue. So when they're breaking apart the batteries, there's a lot of acid and muck and stuff that flies up in the air and it flies around. When they're actually recovering the lead from the batteries and being putting them in the furnace, there's a lot of this dust that almost looks like dirt, but it's lead that gets created and is spewing in the air. That environment is very, very dangerous. Because it's not just lead in that dust, it's also other toxins, cadmium and arsenic, which arsenic gets created arsenic is used to try to refine the lead at another stage in the process. Arsenic and cadmium is cancer causing. And so those respirators are crucial to being able to keep the workers safe. And what we found in the story was that oftentimes the levels were hundreds of times higher than what the federal limit was. And on most days or many days, it would be, you know, well beyond, the levels would be well beyond what the respirators could protect against. And so on many, many days, the workers are working there and they're thinking they're protected. And they're literally breathing all of those toxins and all of those chemicals in. And the medical tests that are required to be done by the federal government for a company to operate around this kind of stuff, the federal government requires a regular set of testing and requires a doctor to be contracted to look at this stuff and to ensure that the workers aren't getting sick because of their exposure. And our story found that entire system had collapsed. And so as the workers were getting more and more of these toxins in their bloodstream, and the medical testing was showing that, the doctor was essentially looking the other way. And when they started to have clear health effects, kidney tests that were showing problems with their kidneys, tests that were showing their blood pressure rising up and other problems, the doctor would just essentially ignore it, check it off as clinically insignificant, and send them back into the workspace without any real warning or not taking any steps to protect their health. And worse, when as the company was doing their testing and these reports were showing these astronomical levels, and their workers were getting more and more higher and higher blood lead results. When workers would get sick or they would talk to the company about it, instead of saying, yeah, you're working around an area where the level is 20 times higher than your respirator, the company would blame the worker and say, well, you must not be cleaning. You must not be doing something right. And in some cases, they will write the worker up and punish them for not keeping their blood lead levels within a certain range. And so it was amazing to see all of this happening. And what was also shocking was that until we started to piece it together, the workforce had no idea that the levels were too high. And they had no idea that they were getting rolled up and punished when, in fact, it didn't matter what they did, that they were ingesting too much of those toxins and it was going to do some real damage to them. There were people who even died. We found at least 14 workers just within a 5-year period that had heart attacks or strokes as a result, and they who also had high lead counts in their blood. We counted about 16 children where the environment was so dusty that some of the workers were taking that dust home on the bottom of their shoes, or it had crept into the back of their skin or their hair, and they would take it home and the baby would hug them, or the baby would play somewhere where the dust had gotten tracked in, and then the baby would get poisoned and have some kind of, there was at least 16 kids, but that's an undercount. There were far more children that got exposed and ended up having some consequences. In some cases, we found the children had blood lead levels that were higher than their father as a result of getting this exposure. And so there were real consequences that was happening as a result of what the company was doing and not doing.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Corey Johnson, who spent 5 years as an investigative reporter with the Tampa Bay Times working on Poisoned, an 18-month, 3-part Pulitzer Prize-winning series. It's about Gopher Resource, a lead factory in Tampa, Florida, where workers extract lead from used car batteries, melt it down, and turn it into blocks of metal to resell. Corey Johnson is now a reporter with ProPublica. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Corey Johnson, who spent 5 years as a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times working on Poisoned, an 18-month, 3-part series. The other reporters, Rebecca Woolington and Eli Murray. It's about Gopher Resource, a lead factory in Tampa, Florida, where workers extract lead from used car batteries, melt it down, and turn it into blocks of metal to resell. Hundreds of workers were exposed to dangerous levels of lead, and the consequences have been profound. Corey, you described in great detail what it's like for these workers to be inside this factory with these hazmat suits. And in the first part of the series, there's this horrific video that was taken in 2019. And I mean, it's just amazing to see this worker who is pretty much just covered in what looks like plumes of smoke. And I understand you all found out that that's actually a plume of lead. Yes. I mean, it's just, you can't even imagine being in that environment and what that would do to your body.
Yeah. You know, what's weird was that there was so much of that kind of evidence that workers saw on a daily basis they thought it was cool to look at. And so they might, they took little pictures of it or video on their phone. And had no idea what that it wasn't supposed to be like that. That was a dangerous situation that shouldn't have existed. And what was crucial for us was getting that video and being able to put it all together so people could see. Like, it was nothing for a worker to say, well, we can't see in there. Like, there's so much of the dust in the air that you have to walk slowly because you literally can't see in front of you. And I thought that was hyperbole. I thought that maybe some people were pulling my coat until they turned over video that you absolutely can't see on many days because it's that crowded. It's that polluted. The air is just covered in that stuff. And that video that we have on part one, the worker there was telling us, look, the ventilation system does not work as good as it's supposed to. And that dust cloud that you see actually sits in that room for a good 30 or 45 minutes before it actually dissipates. And all of that is lead. And the reason why it was horrifying for me and our team when we were doing the lead and water report, the scientists were telling us that it only took two Starbucks coffee grain sized pieces of lead to permanently brain damage a child. So if you can imagine, it only takes a little bit of that poison to do a lot of harm. And you see a video showing this avalanche. It just kind of drives home, right, the danger and the peril that the workers were in. I have to say this, too, about the reporting process of this. It wasn't easy. Not only did we have to deal with the fact that this is a private company and the regular tools that reporters use to try to get information, we can use what's called Freedom of Information Act laws, where we can write a request up to a government agency, ask for some information under these laws, and the government generally will turn them over, or at least they're required to turn them over in accordance to the law. Well, that tool doesn't apply to a private company. So we couldn't send a request over to Gopher Resource asking for all this information because by law they're private. They don't have to do that. We thought that the government might have some information, so we sent some records requests there, and the government was completely unhelpful. We fought them for well over a year, and by the time we got something, their little black markers had blacked it out, so it looked like they had played tick-a-tack-a-toe with those reports, and they really didn't turn over anything of any real consequence. And so it was a conundrum. How do we piece together exactly what's happening at this plant? And so ultimately, reaching out to as many workers we could find was the way in, but that had its own challenges. You know, I'm a black reporter, as you know, most people know who know my work and who can Google me and see. And the plant is predominantly black or black immigrants. So on its face, you might think that I would have had an easy time, but that wasn't the case at all. Largely for two reasons. One, the plant had a very heavy, and still does, surveillance system where they had cameras everywhere, and they had workers who, you know, oftentimes reported back to management on every conversation they heard. And so for these workers, a lot of them, again, this is their second chance, or this is a job they're looking at and they're proud of because it's allowing them to make good money for their family. They didn't want to do anything that could jeopardize that or cause themselves to be out of favor with management. So that was one piece. The other piece, there's this really bad history around Black professionals who work for white institutions that I kept running into over and over again. And it was a huge challenge to overcome it. You know, in the Black community, there's, you know, this is not a secret, but it's not talked about that often, that in the past when there were institutions who might didn't do the community good, whether it was the insurance or you know, doctors doing experiments or the police or whatever else, they would oftentimes send Black people into the community to do harm, to sell the bad meat or to sell the bad insurance policy or infiltrate the civil rights organization or, you know, give the unnecessary surgery and now you don't have no foot and you came in because your throat was sore. I mean, there's all these real life horror stories of Black professionals who were not operating for the best interests of the community. And so I had a hard time initially trying to convince people that I wanted to interview that I was not the FBI. Wow. You know, so I would go to the door and knock on the door because folks were not answering phone calls or random text messages or random emails or Facebook. So I would have to go and knock on the door and introduce myself. And they were like, man, if you don't get your little FBI ass off around here. And I would say, hey, I'm not the FBI. You know, I'm Corey Johnson. I'm with the Tampa Bay Times. And they'd be like, same difference.
Wow.
And so there were a lot of shut doors. There were a lot of avoidance, in fact, when I started to break through, it was because there were a few folks who had gotten their records and shared their records and began to believe in what we were doing, who spoke up on our behalf. And so that built over time. It didn't happen initially, but it built. And when I say got their records, we discovered within the federal rules that workers had this ability to get the pollution testing and the medical testing from a company where the member of the public could not. And so we began to ask various workers if they'd be willing to get their records and share it with us. And that's how we discovered the incredibly high levels and the stuff that the doctor was doing and not doing. That's how we first discovered it, that some workers got their records and shared it to us. And so we then, with their permission, were able to take some of those pieces to some of the more reluctant workers and ask if they would be willing to give me 5 minutes to explain that I wasn't selling anything, I wasn't the IRS, that I wasn't the police, I was not immigration, there wasn't going to be no $49.99 offer at the end of this, that instead it was just us trying to figure out, or we may have a reason why they keep going to the hospital every couple weeks. Because the one unifying thing that was happening to almost everybody in that plant was they would end up in the hospital with some type of ailment that could be linked to the lead or the cadmium that they were being exposed to.
I mean, the stories that you all tell are heartbreaking. You've got photos in the piece. Just a couple examples. Kevin Lewis's heart pounded so hard and fast while he worked in the furnace department. The 26-year-old, he's only 26, couldn't catch his breath. He was whisked away by ambulance. Larry Wheeler became disoriented and fainted while working in one of the dustier areas of the plant. An ambulance rushed the 39-year-old to the hospital, where medical staff told him to limit his exposure to lead. James Pitts 49, blacked out with an erratic heart rate. As he walked from the locker room to start his maintenance shift, he was taken by paramedics to the hospital. And his story after story, do you want to spend a little time telling us about Prosper Dumas?
Yes. So Prosper Dumas was a Haitian worker who immigrated from Haiti to and ended up in Tampa, Florida, doing what a lot of immigrants do. Well, they were looking for a better life. They were looking for opportunity. He lived in an island of Haiti that was tremendously poor. And his sister, Madeline, had come to America first in the early 80s and had sent for him as an option. And so he came, he got a job at the plant, and it became his life. I think he worked well over 32 years at that plant. And he was one of those guys that became like a specialist. There was nothing Dumas couldn't do. He could drive the loaders. He was very fast, so much so that he enjoyed like some seniority and respect in the plant, because if people had a problem or something they didn't know, they would go to Dumas and he would tell them. He would tell them the workaround. He'd tell them the fix to whatever the problem was. And management loved him. He and a lot of the Haitian workers, they go above and beyond. If the task requires them to work 8 hours, they're going to work 12. If they have to work 15, they're going to work 18. It was just what they did in their approach to work. But what the downside to that was, he was getting injured often. That hot molten lead would splash, you know, from time to time. That plant would have regular explosions where hot lead and water do not go together well. And so if it rained and the building had leaks, that water would leak into the building. It would hit somewhere where that lead was, and it would cause an explosion. And so people would be running because of the lead explosions that were happening. Dumas got caught a few times with lead explosions. So his body was greatly scarred. At one point, he had a lead explosion in the 90s that hit like the entire side of his body. And he struggled with that for the rest of his life because his injuries never really healed from that. He also, in the early 90s, started to deal with real heart problems as a result of his exposure. I mean, Dumas had levels that far exceeded what the CDC, like perhaps 8-9 times higher than what the CDC now considers to be high. And one point that I want to make too about the story, this story also documents that the federal government's limit on how much lead someone can safely have in their body is way too high. And the government knows about it. Scientists know about it. Medical officials know about it. But because that high level is so treasured by companies who do this kind of work, they don't want to see that level come down, because if it comes down, it will require them to spend billions more in safety for workers. And because of that, those levels have been set at the same levels that they were when they were first created in the late 1970s. Even though science and medicine demands that they come down because they're way too high. Dumas was a victim of this. His levels, which were in the 40s, which are insane in the eyes of the medical community, but in terms of the federal government's limit, he wasn't hitting 60. And so therefore he could be on paper look safe when in actuality he was not. And one of the things that we wanted to do, the federal government doesn't take into account the cumulative amount of lead that a human being can be exposed to and what kind of damage it could do. And so Rebecca Woolerton reached out to an expert who has been doing a lot of the cutting edge research on cumulative exposure. And the expert worked with us to come up with a formula where we could then take all of his medical tests and plug it into the formula to get a sense of how much lead Dumas had been exposed to. And the number was astronomical. Mm-hmm. It was akin to eating a poison pill every day of his life for well over 30 some years. Mm-hmm. And so the amount of, I mean, he ended up having many heart surgeries. And when you looked at Dumas, you would have never known that this man and his heart was so damaged. I mean, he was a strong looking man, very much in shape, but on the inside, the lead had just been eating away at his cardiovascular systems and his kidneys and other systems. And so right around 2017, he had another heart surgery. And after that surgery, his doctor suggested that he not be made to lift anything over 20 pounds. And it was at that point the company decided to fire him. And he begged for his job. It was the only job he knew. His sister wanted him to leave the business because it was killing him. And she said as much. But he was so drawn to the work and the camaraderie, he did not want to leave. And then when the company pushed him out, because he was essentially no more use to them anymore, he went into a deep depression. And maybe a month or so after he was terminated, he was at church and he had this massive heart attack. And the tragedy, one of the real tragic pieces of that, as he lied on the ground in church, a lot of the folks knew where he worked and they did not want to give him CPR. They did not put their lips on him because they too were concerned about being contaminated. And by the time the paramedics got to him, he was still alive, but he suffered, you know, real significant brain damage. And that brain damage resulted in him having like the sudden seizures where he would just shake uncontrollably, very violently. Ultimately, it led him to being placed into a home. And then ultimately he died. And he died in his 50s. And it's tragic. And he's not the only one. Even after the story's published, you know, I've gone to funerals of other veterans at the plant that we didn't get a chance to report on, who too had long exposure to this lead, so much so, but yet they came underneath the federal rules of what was safe and unsafe.
Well, and that's the key question, Corey. And unfortunately, we only have about a minute left, but we'd love to do a follow-up on what it would take to change the official levels of what is allowed. It seems like that's the major issue here, that this was happening. Officials said they didn't know it was happening. And is it safe to assume that this is happening in some of the other recycling factories? And is this, and then what has really changed at Gopher Resource?
Well, yes. So these levels are impacting everyone that's in the lead business. And the American Public Health Association, after seeing the story, wrote a letter to OSHA, which is the Occupational Health and Safety Administration, calling for them to read the stories and to bring those levels down. OSHA says they're looking at doing so. And so they've created a process where they're taking comment from the community as they try to figure out what changes they're going to make. But absolutely, this is a problem that's impacting other folks. In this story, there was more than just that. There was that piece, but then there were other things, that housekeeping rules that the company was violating, that OSHA came in and absolutely is trying to hold them account to. And the county regulators have deemed not only fined the plant, but they're requiring the plant to hire an expert to get the ventilation system together and to bring in new technology that will immediately communicate with the government when systems begin to fail. And so there is a push to get Gopher much safer. The other piece too is there's a ton of lawyers out here now, including civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump, who has been more famous. He was Trayvon Martin's attorney, and he's been serving as the attorney for a lot of the victims of these police shootings. He has signed up a bunch of workers, and they have already filed one lawsuit. They say other lawsuits may be filed in the days and weeks ahead. So there's a big push to make sure that what happened at Gopher never happens again, both civilly and with government regulators.
Corey Johnson spent 5 years as an investigative reporter with the Tampa Bay Times working on the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigation called Poisoned. Corey is now a reporter with ProPublica. Corey, thank you so much for your incredible work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance engineered our show. And I hope you can take the time to read Poisoned, an 18-month, three-part series. You can find it at yourcallradio.org.